From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Internationally acclaimed author Ian McEwan is known as a masterful communicator of unease. Since 9/11, the whole world has entered that realm, a realm of pervasive unease. In his latest novel, McEwan takes one day in the life of one man and draws the ocean of unease that lies now beneath, within every moment of his life and ours. Tonight on Point, writer Ian McEwan, his new novel, Saturday, and life in the world after 9/11. But first, a new warning that commercial nuclear power plants across the country are vulnerable to terrorist attack. A report from the National Academy of Sciences, commissioned by Congress, has found that tens of thousands of tons of spent fuel that sits for a five-year cool-down period in nuclear power plants is at risk. Ralph Vardabedian is national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what fear drove the commissioning of this report.
Well, the U.S. Congress had asked the National Academies of Science to examine this issue because since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, there have been growing concerns about vulnerabilities at a range of sites and facilities across the country, and obviously any place that stores radioactive materials would be potentially vulnerable and exploitable by terrorists.
So Congress asked the National Academy of Sciences to look into this, but they didn't ask them to look into the whole nuclear reactors, but to the spent nuclear fuel containment facilities. Why that particular focus?
I asked that question myself of the National Academy, and they said they couldn't even answer it themselves. I think that the NRC has independently examined the containment building issue, and that the containment building issue is probably a lesser concern because containment buildings are more substantial structures. They're intended to contain a nuclear meltdown, and as a result, they're probably far more resistant to an attack from the outside, whereas these spent fuel storage facilities are not reinforced structures above the pools. So I think there's been a substantial amount of concern that these would be an easier target than the containment buildings that have the reactors in them.
So let's look then at this particular target. You say every nuclear power plant has these spent nuclear fuel rods. Why? What are they doing there?
Well, after the nuclear fuel rods in a reactor have expended a significant portion of their energy, they have to be removed. When they're removed, they're still extremely radioactive, and a lot of thermal heat is being given off. Before you can do anything with them, they have to be removed from the reactor and put in a cooling pool, where for up to 5 years, the radioactive material, the uranium inside those rods, will continue to decay and give off heat into the water, and the water is then pumped through, cooled, and filtered.
So they come out of the containment facility. They're put into these cooling pools for 5 years at every commercial nuclear plant around the country. And the National Academy of Sciences was asked to look at their vulnerability there. What kind of attack did they describe that might create a danger?
All of the attack scenarios were contained in a classified version of the report that was sent to Congress and not released publicly. But members of the panel confirmed to me that they examined both airborne and ground attacks and combinations of those. We can imagine that those examinations included the potential for crashing a jetliner into a building that houses one of these pools, or presumably terrorist assault teams, ground assault teams that would penetrate the sites and use various kinds of explosives to attack the pools.
And as you describe it, what they would essentially be aiming to do would be to breach a spent fuel pool, allowing the cooling water to drain out. If the cooling water drained out around the spent fuel rods, what's the danger? How would it become airborne or a menace to public health?
Well, first of all, the pools are substantial structures by themselves. The pool walls are 5 feet of steel-reinforced concrete and a stainless steel liner. So it would require a significant explosive charge, certainly within the capability of an assault team, but it would require a significant explosive charge to breach that. Some of these pools are below grade. In other words, they're underground, just like a backyard swimming pool. Very difficult to attack those. Some of them are above grade, in which the pool walls are elevated. Those would be more vulnerable. the intent of a terrorist would be to breach that wall and somehow allow all of the water or most of the water to drain out. Once the water drains out, if there are certain fuel rods that have recently come out of the reactor, they would be generating very high levels of heat, enough heat to cause a combustion of the zirconium cladding around the fuel rods. Each of these fuel rods are contained in tiny little tubes that have uranium pellets in them, and the rods are clad with a metal called zirconium, which is combustible. And if there was a combustion of that zirconium, it could reach high enough temperatures to melt the uranium pellets inside and vaporize them and send out a radioactive plume.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry say they're not worried. They're disputing the Academy's conclusions that this is a threat. Spokesman for the industry said he's more worried about getting hit by a meteor walking out of his front door in the morning. Will there be follow-up on this? Will there be changes either in the way nuclear power plants are guarded or built?
Well, certainly all of this has got to be seriously considered. Both the Congress and the NRC are going to have to seriously consider what the National Academy has returned. This is a panel of capable, highly respected experts that have put the government, federal government, on notice that they believe that there's a vulnerability here. It's tough to believe that Congress and the NRC will ignore them.
Ralph Vardabedian, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Ralph Vardabedian is national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Los Angeles. On September 12, 2001, acclaimed novelist Ian McEwan published an essay in London's Guardian newspaper, Beyond Belief, it was headlined. He had watched the attacks of September 11th unfold with a sickened wonderment, he said, because, as McEwan writes, American reality always outstrips the imagination. Devastating words from a writer known for his own powerful, provocative imagination. It is that sense of foreboding, the shock of knowing how, in a world woven tightly by politics and media, germs and jet fuel, life can change in an instant, that McEwan explores in his new novel, Saturday. The prize-winning novelist of Amsterdam and Atonement takes us into one day in the life of Harry Perrone, a London neurosurgeon, happy husband and father, who in another time should be a contented man. But this is post-9/11, and McEwan's Perrone struggles with a new reality where individuals wonder if it is still possible to keep their humanity close as a violent world gets closer. It is a powerful look at one life and at all our lives now. Tonight on Point, Ian McEwan, his new novel Saturday, and Life in the World After 9/11. We spoke with Ian McEwan a few days ago, before the death this week of novelist Saul Bellow. McEwan is a deep admirer of Bellow and opens Saturday with a quotation from Bellow's 1964 novel Herzog, where Herzog asks himself what it means to be a man in a city, in a century, in transition, threatened by so much of the world, and answers himself that it means being a brother to the rest, or else, in Bellow's words, an ingrate, dilettante, idiot. Now, our conversation with Ian McEwan. Ian McEwan, welcome.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. And really a wonderful book, engrossing from the very beginning, and I have to say woke me up in a way that a good writer can to a kind of layers of my own unease, of all our unease that I just hadn't really explored, though they all play through the backs of our minds. But there's this. You've written about unease in many novels and short stories at this point for many years. And here you've got it as a backdrop, as a post-9/11 backdrop, but how do you describe it? Is the unease today different from the unease of all time, of all places, of all men and women?
Well, it's very difficult to begin to get a full historical perspective on the changes we're going through, and part of the backdrop to this novel is not only a sense of the world having radically changed after 9/11, but also, I allow for a sort of little skeptical strand, too. I mean, we've been through some even far worse things in the first half of the 20th century.
You refer to the Blitz of London at one point, when he's looking out his window early in the morning.
Well, that was terrible enough, but we've also lived, you know, in those times, the humanity lived through the Holocaust, the First World War, the great flu epidemic of 1918, the tyrannies of various totalitarian states and mass famine in China and so on. So, you know, we have to be a little careful.
And a little modest.
Well, I think we may be witnessing a great shift in life in modern times. On the other hand, we might well find, and Henri Perrone sometimes thinks as he goes down the street and it's daylight again, he's no longer worrying in the middle of the night and the street looks so familiar and everything so reassuring. Maybe we're getting this out of proportion. He doesn't know. That's the point about this man. He's not a man of certainties. He's a man of great ambivalence. He doesn't know. Perhaps we'll find that 10, 15, 20 years down the line, it's actually climate change that's filling our thoughts.
And forget terrorism. That was just a moment.
Terrorism may well fade. Who knows? We might find the beginnings of some success in the Middle East and perhaps, you know, what's happening in shifts in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, the new democracy movement in Lebanon, slow but painful move to democracy in Iraq, the collapse of Osama's, bin Laden's networks. It all turns out to have been a horrible but, you know, decade-long nightmare. And there are, you know, other concerns down the line. Or is it 100 years of, you know, more of this?
As has been suggested.
Yeah. And it's between these two poles, really, that Henri Perrone's thoughts travel. You know, the world has fundamentally changed, or it hasn't fundamentally changed. And life goes on and all the same human concerns are still here. That's the kind of mix I was wanting to get into his thoughts.
I think you got it very well. Ian McEwan, British novelist. His new novel is Saturday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the acclaimed British novelist Ian McEwan. His new novel is Saturday, a novel really about living post 9/11, about living with perpetual unease. He joins me in the studio. Ian McEwan, I wish you'd be good enough to take us into some of the story here. We began to lay out a few of the pieces, but this is a day, one day, not so long ago, early 2003 maybe. He talks about it being 18 months after 9/11. A well-off, maybe not rich, but very comfortable London neurosurgeon wakes up very early one morning, maybe what, 2 or 3 a.m., and you proceed to take him right on through that day. He stands in his open window, looks out on the world, and feels a kind of elation, standing naked there with that crisp air, cold air coming in, and then a streak across the sky, the edge of his sight, and it's kind of that reminder of things unknown, things menacing, of our vulnerability. It turns out to be a burning airplane in the night sky.
That's right. I mean, it's almost as if his unease materializes for him in this form. At first, he thinks it's something like a meteorite, as you say, but it's a familiar trajectory, left to right across the night sky. He's looking south across London. It's a plane making its descent towards Heathrow. And that really is the trigger for an immediate speculation about how we do live in different times, how even the shape of an innocent airliner now looks either predatory or doomed. They no longer have that kind of simple, innocent, business-like quality. They have become laden with significance.
Harbingers or weapons themselves.
Yes, exactly. Human-filled weapons. And that's really the beginning, I mean, of a 24-hour stretch in which Henry will first of all learn that the story is not quite what he thought, and he's relieved, and then hear later on that there are more worrying aspects to this, and yet there's a, you know, further developments. So this plane really threads its way through his day. It is not, in fact, a fatal accident, nor is it a terrorist attack, but it's the readiness to entertain that possibility that's new in our lives, I suppose. And Henry then moves about his day. He, as you say, is a fairly happy man. He's got good family relations. I tried to give him a degree of contentment and pleasures. He likes his wine, sex, love.
Starts out very contented. I must say that the beginning of the book is like, oh, this is lovely. I'm inside the mind of a very happy man. What a pleasant place to be, except for that meteor across the night sky.
Yeah. You know, he's looking forward to the return home of his older child, Daisy, who's just about to publish her first volume of poems.
Coming home from Paris.
She's in from Paris. Also coming is his grandfather, I mean, Daisy's grandfather, a famous poet himself. And Henry's Perrone's task is to effect a bit of a reunion and reconciliation between the two. And this is a very special day, too, in the city itself, because February the 15th, 2003, mm-hmm. was the day of an absolutely colossal anti-war demonstration.
Advance of the Iraq war, against the looming war.
Yeah, the war is only several weeks away, and probably the largest gathering of humanity that the British Isles has ever known takes place in the centre of London. And I myself live in the centre of London, so it was watching that march, not actually so much make its way through London, but beginning to gather, that I suddenly saw at that point that I should just make this day the length of the novel.
Let's grab this.
It was Seize the Day, to take mm-hmm. Bellow's title. Mm-hmm. It is, of course, a form with a long literary history. Towering over us all is Joyce and Ulysses. But
Bellow and Herzog.
Bellow, certainly, and Mrs. Dalloway, and Don DeLillo's one recently. And oddly enough, I mean, it was a kind of gift.
That day of demonstration, the way it framed 24 hours.
Yes, because I'd already started writing this novel, and I thought that I would let history write the background. The trouble is, the background was beginning to be a little tedious because it was endless comings and goings at the UN, and Hans Blix's first and second report, and Colin Powell standing up to give what we know now as completely erroneous intelligence briefing to the world.
And then it delivered for you, one big day.
And oddly, when you have that kind of limitation of 24 hours, you're set free. Form can set you free. It's like a poet who decides to write a sonnet, and in those three quatrains and a couplet, you can find all life.
I have to say, I found it that way as a reader. I was very, very quickly, practically unaware that it was the 24-hour, kind of mechanism was surrounding this. It just flowed.
Also, it's not as confining as it sounds, because you can always go backwards.
Which you do. Plenty of flashbacks.
There's
here.
Plenty of flashbacks. And one of the clumsiest tenses in the English language is the past perfect. You know, he had thought. He had mm-hmm. an idea. If you start in the present, if that's your narrative center, you go back only into the simple past.
Yes,
and I thought that was a great deliverance, too.
Right. A novelist relief. Why, I wonder, you could have chosen anyone. You could have chosen a man or woman. You could have chosen a taxi driver or a politician or a ditch digger. You chose a neurosurgeon. Why?
I wanted my man to have a job, a work. I always think that too many characters in contemporary novels seem to be unemployed, too busy with their existence and their relationships to ever sort of earn a crust.
This character is very deeply rooted in his work.
Yeah, and I thought that I would give him difficult work and that I would become absorbed in this work. So whatever it was going to be, I was going to learn it or something about it too. And so, you know, neurosurgery obviously fits into that very well. But also, I suppose I always knew this character was going to be a fairly rational man of no religious belief, who was something of a materialist. He believes, you know, that the mind is really what the brain does. He doesn't believe in the soul or any divine spark. So I thought, well, why not? I mean, I was thinking way ahead. There's going to be a time, if he's a neurosurgeon, that we will be able to see him open up a brain and maybe put his hand on a brain, on mere matter that has done this extraordinary thing, organized itself, as it were, through evolution into producing this inward cinema of thoughts and dreams and aspirations. So I was interested from that point of view, even though I, of course, then having started to spend time with neurosurgeons.
You had to go into the surgery and watch them do what they did to get the feel.
Yeah, but they don't sit around having metaphysical thoughts about the mind-body problem. I mean, they're just too busy, deeply involved with their patients. But it was, for me, a wonderful education. And, I spent 2 years on and off, in and out of an operating theatre and the corridors around the hospital and hanging out in the coffee rooms with the surgeons.
And that breathes in this book, the passage where he describes the surgery on the young woman who would be his wife, her face kind of lifted, the surgeon going up behind her lip, under her nose, into the center of her brain to pull out an exploding gland in there. Very detailed and realistic.
Yeah, this is a transphenoidal hypophysectomy.
Oh, of course.
And as you well know. And
yes,
this route into this difficult place, I mean, it's quite hard to get to the pituitary, but developed over decades, you know, and an operation that was abandoned at one stage and then reinvented by a Canadian.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's rather like the history of flight. You know, you get on that Boeing and it's boring and safe. But, you know, many, many attempts and failures lie behind it. And that's what's so impressive, too, the sort of sense of tradition and roots through the brain that were tried and then opened up again. It's a bit like the Northwest Passage.
And to meet one's wife that way, with her face being lifted right off the bones of her skull.
Well, one's future wife, yes. Yeah. It's not the way most people get to know each other. That's true.
Now, he's also very comfortable. When he pads into the bathroom early in the morning, it's a marble floor. His place somewhere in central London, it's very wonderfully appointed. It's a very comfortable life. His car is a lovely Mercedes. Why the affluence? To heighten the kind of contrast between his daily well-padded life and this unease behind?
A little of that. I mean, at some point in his day, fairly early on, he's going to have a fender bender with a character who is going to provide a great deal of tension and threat in his existence, a low-level thug who himself has got a neurodegenerative disease. And I suppose I'm not really writing an allegory or a parable here, but I suppose I saw in Henry the contented, wealthy, affluent, often quite rational societies of the West, with their access to information, their power, and their general levels of health and contentment. And that all this comes under threat from a very irrational source, a man whose pride Henry is injured, who also suffers from Huntington's disease, a really serious neurodegenerative disease, is going to come bursting into Henry's life.
A disease that Henry detects and puts that detection to very important use at a very tense moment. You may not intend it allegorically, but then that affluent West set upon by an angry, afflicted kind of predator, it sure sounds like allegory when you refer back to 9/11.
Well, when I sum it up like that, it rather does sound like an allegory. But I'm very clear in my mind that I need to build these stories up from the bottom up with the details that will bring them to life rather than say, you know, this thing stands for another thing. But if you ask me why I make him opulent, in a sense, we are all opulent, even if we don't care to admit it, unless you're sort of extremely unfortunate in the bottom, say, 15% of American or British life. On the whole, you know, we're rolling in it from the point of view of someone growing up in the slums on the edge of Rawalpindi. So that's a sort of undercurrent, really.
And it doesn't protect anybody from that meteor, that fire in the night that puts his antenna so high up. I wonder if you'd read just a little bit to give us a feeling here. There's a point early in this single day in Ian McEwan's new novel, Saturday, where the neurosurgeon, Harry Perrone, has awakened very early, and after musing in front of his open window, looking out into London's night sky, he pads downstairs and finds his son, Theo, a young musician, who I was delighted to see at somewhere along the way learning his blues and guitars, run across Ry Cooder, personal hero, who's given him a signature, an autograph on a beer a beer coaster. But he comes down to his son, and there's a kind of an exchange you describe here inside his mind about this kind of ambient sense of dread or vulnerability and how his son's dealing with it. Ian McEwan, if you could just set this passage up for us.
So Henry Perrone comes downstairs, having watched this burning plane in the sky. He finds his son Theo there. Theo's a blues musician, always up late at night. And Henry tells Theo about what he's seen. And they've watched the TV news. There's nothing on there yet. So Theo suggests they sit around and wait for the next news to come around. And Theo is said to his father, "Do you think it's jihadists?" Perrone is feeling dizzy, pleasantly so. Everything he looks at, including his son's face, is receding from him without growing smaller. He hasn't heard Theo use this word before. Is it the right word? It sounds harmless, even quaint, rendered in his light tenor. This deepening of the boyish treble is an advance Henry still can't entirely take for granted, even though it's 5 years old. On Theo's lips, he takes the trouble to do something fancy with the J. The Arabic word sounds as innocuous as some stringed Moroccan instrument the band might take up and electrify. In the ideal Islamic state, under strict Sharia law, there'll be room for surgeons. Blues guitarists will be found other employment. But perhaps no one is demanding such a state. Nothing is demanded. Only hatred is registered, the purity of nihilism. As a Londoner, you could grow nostalgic for the IRA. Even as your legs left your body, you might care to remember the cause was a united Ireland. Now that's coming anyway, according to the Reverend Ian Paisley, through the power of the perambulator. Another crisis fading into the scrapbooks after a mere 30 years. But that's not quite right. Radical Islamists aren't really nihilists. They want the perfect society on earth, which is Islam. They belong in a doomed tradition about which Perrone takes the conventional view. The pursuit of utopia ends up licensing every form of excess, all ruthless means of its realization. If everyone is sure to end up happy forever, what crime can it be to slaughter a million or two now? "I don't know what I think," Henry says. "It's too late to think. Let's wait for the news."
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There from Ian McEwan's new novel, Saturday, is with his son, imagining, thinking about different kinds of menace, remembering the IRA with something almost like a nostalgia. His son responds by saying that he's realized any time he thinks about the large situation in the world, it's always looks like hell. So he prefers to think small about, he says, going snowboarding next month or the things right in front of him. I think I was fascinated throughout by this exchange between generations around this new menace. Of course, his son, who's just a late teenager, 9/11 came very early in his life. It's kind of part of the accepted furniture for Henry. It's a shocking, stunning thing that still burns against his earlier experience. I wonder how you see this generational dynamic playing out in the UK.
It's interesting for, you know, when you come of age, when you start to sort of take in the outside world, as maybe in your early teens or mid-teens, start to pick up a newspaper, this is the world you find. You know, this is the steady state. So Theo coming of age and his first real engagement with public events is 9/11. That's the first time he really looks beyond school.
Hello, young man. Here's the world.
This is it. And from then on, all that obsession and security, and in London we had tanks out at the airport, mm-hmm. and a storming of a mosque, and all kinds of new events. This is the world he finds. Whereas for Henry, and I gave him a good bit of myself in this, becomes a complete news junkie. I mean, reading two or three newspapers a day. And I was reading books on Islam and books on imperialism and histories of
everybody suddenly
news.
Diving in.
Yeah, we all
what
suddenly
is
become experts on things that we never had expected to learn about. And I suppose we could take a positive view of this, that a culture that suddenly is under attack, well, one of its first responses is to want to know more. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. We can't.
Not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing. We could at least try and see some good in that. That was one response to learn about this. So there is a generational divide between father and son. Theo tends to look at the newspapers for fresh developments rather as he might a listings magazine.
Mm-hmm. If what's going on?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If there's anything bad happening, then maybe he'll read it. But otherwise, he just checks to make sure that it's all steady.
The level of unease that Perrone feels in this book, is it yours? Or have you drawn it? Is it a pastiche of people you know, of headlines? Or is it Ian McEwan's?
It's pretty close to my own. But in saying that, I think I don't think I was alone in this. No. I gave him a great deal of my... I've never quite written such a an autobiographical novel. Not entirely, obviously, but I gave him elements. Theo is very much like my youngest son, Greg. The neighbourhood is entirely described.
And we can feel it. We've got to take a short break. Ian McEwan's new novel is Saturday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about living post 9/11 with perpetual unease. My guest is Ian McEwan. His new novel is Saturday, one day in the life of a London neurosurgeon that is framed all around and woven all through with a peculiar kind of post 9/11 unease of fire in the sky and trouble in the streets and trouble that ultimately comes right in to the doctor's comfortable home. Ian McEwan, you've got a kind of reputation of writing about tough stuff, things that make people squirm. Ian Macabre, you're an early tag thrown on you. I mean, great work right throughout. But does this feel materially different? Do you find yourself... I mean, you've always poked your readers in the face with tough situations, weird, even perverse relationships, dark secrets. Now it's a very public, shared... kind of monumental scale of unease. How does it feel to deal with that as opposed to your earlier work?
Well, people often used to ask me why I wrote about ordinary lives suddenly transformed by moments of horrifying violence and, well, what was 9/11? And then exactly that, ordinary people going about their business and then, you know, plunged into a nightmare. Yes, my early work was very... often very tight and dark, and I have to say that, you know, there came a point with my second novel, The Comfort of Strangers, which was my fourth book, that I came to a pause and thought, I've written myself into a hole here.
It's too dark, it's too tight.
It's too private and individual, and what I then did was I started to write, I wrote a television film, set in the Second World War, and then I wrote a political movie called The Plowman's Lunch about the Thatcher years, and I wrote an oratorio with a composer about the nuclear arms race, and then came back to fiction with a much stronger sense of wanting to include more of the world in it, and that novel was The Child in Time. And from then on, really, I've always been interested in ways in which public events... public shifts of attention and history permeate the private life. I mean, the interaction between moments, say, around the Berlin Wall in the 60s, or with the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and the effects that has on the private lives of people in a novel of mine called Black Dogs. And so, you know, in a way, I felt that 9/11, in some awful way, was my subject, really.
Made for Ian McEwan.
In this respect, that large-scale shifts in, you know, foreign policy and nations on the move to war also had their equivalents in the very fine print of people's ordinary lives. It penetrated deep into the sort of into love affairs, into the way we felt about ourselves, even. So, although my first response, and I think it was everyone's who was a writer and wanted to write about 9/11, made this decision, the first response is journalism. I mean, and reportage. And
your essay is right after.
Yeah, and I think the profession as a whole acquitted itself very well. I mean, front pages were cleared. I mean, in London, for example, the story breaking just after lunch. The next morning, there were 36 pages of analysis, photographs, reportage, vox pops.
Oh, it filled all our minds. But it's the way it reached into the intimate that I found so compelling, and you bring it to life in this novel, in Saturday. There's one more passage I wish you'd read, which really goes directly to that, where Henry Perrone is... This is still very early morning. He's back in bed with with his wife Rosalind, a wife that he loves, a wife that he's still very drawn to in every way after their years of marriage. And there's a passage that, well, where that big world and the looming war in Iraq and more come into that kind of most intimate setting of a husband and wife curled around each other still in the dark of an early morning. I wish you could read from that, Ian McEwan.
The bedroom air is fresh in his nostrils. He's half aroused sexually as he moves closer to Rosalind. He can hear the first stirring of steady traffic on the Euston Road, like a breeze moving through a forest of firs. People who have to be at work by six on a Saturday. The thought of them doesn't make him feel sleepy, as it often does. He thinks of sex. If the world were configured precisely to his needs, he would be making love to Rosalind now, without preliminaries, to a very willing Rosalind, and afterwards falling in a clear-headed swoon towards sleep. But even despotic kings, even the ancient gods, couldn't always dream the world to their convenience. It's only children, in fact only infants, who feel a wish and its fulfilment as one. Perhaps this is what gives tyrants their childish air. They reach back for what they can't have. When they meet frustration, the man's slaying tantrum is never far away. Saddam, for example, doesn't simply look like a heavy-jowled brute. He gives the impression of an overgrown, disappointed boy with a pudgy hangdog look and dark eyes a little baffled by all that he still can't ordain. Absolute power and its pleasures are just beyond reach and keep receding. He knows that another fawning general dispatched to the torture rooms, another bullet in the head of a relative, won't deliver the satisfaction it once did. Barone shifts position and nuzzles the back of Rosalind's head, inhaling the faint tang of perfumed soap mingled with the scent of warm skin and shampooed hair. What a stroke of luck that the woman he loves is also his wife. But how quickly he's drifted from the erotic to Saddam.
From the erotic to Saddam Hussein, with Ian McEwan in his novel Saturday. Not only 9/11 is a looming presence throughout the book, but the Iraq War, as you say, it's set on this February day, February 15th, 2003, when masses of British folks would come into the streets and protest that looming war. Your protagonist, Henry Perrone, has his misgivings, but essentially he's prepared to see it go forward. He's had a patient, an Iraqi patient, who suffered torture at the hands of Saddam's people. And that and the rest of what he's seen have more or less persuaded him that it's time to go ahead. But his daughter is very much opposed to it. We should give us a sense of that tension.
Well, Henry has wavering feelings. I mean, when he talks to his anaesthetist, who's a hawk on the war, Henry becomes a dove. When he confronts his fiery daughter, who's a real, strongly for peace and not for invasion, Henry finds himself moving into the war camp. It's as if he just doesn't quite know what he feels at all. He can see that this is an appalling tyranny and something in him really wants it overthrown. On the other hand, he has strong suspicions that if the invasion is a success, the occupation itself is going to be a terrible mess.
Which makes him a kind of everyman. I mean, how many of us share that sort of, what should have?
So, yeah, he is not filled with fiery certainty, but at least, I mean, I give the whole set piece, I mean, the row between them. And I suppose I have to, again, say that I share something of Henry's ambivalence. I'm probably a little more against the war than he is, but there was always a little voice in my head saying, but it could just work out so well, you know.
And if only.
And are the peace marchers fully aware of the depravities of the regime? And are they offering a real alternative? Are we just going to leave him in place? That horrible phrase, locked in his box. Well, locked in the box would be 25 million other Iraqis with him.
That was so, sort of Hans Blix's box, the UN containment box.
The containment box, in which thousands of children were dying daily through lack of medicines and so on. But, you know, I had great sympathies with the marchers too, so I've given Henry, I thought, the great slew of my own kind of ambivalences and confusions about this.
9/11 hangs over the entire novel, the kind of changed climate that it produced. the Iraq War very vividly because it's practically on the eve of the Iraq War. The other kind of looming figure here is America itself. It's always weaving in. You've got an American character, his squash partner and foe, Jay Strauss, and they have an epic squash battle here. But I'm reading back from your essay of the day after 9/11 about where you wrote in The Guardian, American reality always outstrips the imagination. Also reading here from the book where you, Henry thinks of Jay Strauss as an American who had the warmth and directness that no one else in this English hospital could muster at a critical moment in taking care of one patient. How did you feel the United States as a novelist sitting down to write this? How did you feel it hovering around? What kind of presence? What kind of how imminent to a British writer? What kind of figure?
Well, I feel very, very close to the United States. I come, you know, most years, often, you know, several times. I got married here. Its culture, especially its literature, is very close to my heart. So
visited many times, married here, held up at the border here famously a couple of years ago.
Yeah, this might well be my
just
last...
a year ago now,
this could be my last trip.
It was a kind of an immigration department snag at the border, and here you'd been... held up, but anyway, yes. Yeah, so you've got
I mean, all that trouble still goes on, and this could well be my very last trip.
Seriously,
to the United States. Yeah. I mean, I might be banned from this country for the rest of my life.
They essentially accused you of misrepresenting the purpose of your travels, or the
no. I was absolutely direct. I said I've come here to give a lecture, and they said you can't do that if you're being paid.
Yeah.
Then they accepted they'd made a mistake. They've sent me a very abject letter of apology.
And you're about to be banished anyway?
It's been very, very difficult to get in. It's taken me 9 months to get a visa. It only covers the number of days that I'm here. I have to leave the country by April the 4th.
Are you on some kind of enemies list now?
I think I've just got into the system. I've been refused entry.
Right, however, and therefore there's a little black mark somewhere in your...
And the computer and the...
Yeah.
So it's very, very frustrating for me, actually.
This even when Laura Bush is reputed to be a fan.
Yeah, I might have to drop her a note.
Please, Laura. Please.
It has been turned into an amazing farce. I mean, I haven't spoken to many people about this because it's almost embarrassing because I adore this country.
Except you're one of thousands and thousands. I mean, this very aggressive, rigid new immigration system is unyielding when you get into a tight corner with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, it took me 9 months to get a visa. They wanted to know where I was going to be every hour of my publicity trip, and the visa only came the morning I was due to get on a plane.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and if I stay in this country longer than April the 5th, I'll be committing a crime. I mean, my wife was traveling with me on an ordinary visa. She's allowed to stay here 90 days.
And no intervention from the embassy or a cultural attaché has been able to kind of sponge away the muck that got on your file there?
Everyone has piled in. Lawyers, publishers, well-wishers, people who are actually all the contacts I have were in the Clinton administration. They say it's not very... maybe that's the problem. But I meant to come back to talk at the New Yorker Festival in September.
Yeah. Don't know if you can.
I don't know if I can get in.
Well, that's an amazing testament to just how tough the immigration software can be these days, keeping Ian McEwan on the outside.
Yeah. Keeping you safe from British novelists.
Yeah, safe from British novelists, flinging tomes. But with all that, the U.S., I mean, here you've set your novel on a day when, as you say, maybe the biggest crowd in the history of the British Isles came out to protest a war, but in many ways to protest the United States. I mean, Blair was right in there, but he was co-piloting with Washington.
Exactly, and at the same time, I hope that most people are sensible enough to make the distinction between an administration and a country. It's not the same thing, and I think many people in Britain were well aware that, you know, had it been those hanging chads were all remembered, and had it been a different administration, we'd been in a different foreign policy.
But this reality that always outstrips imagination, you say, the American reality always outstrips the imagination. No, 9/11 it did, but always?
Well, actually what I'm referring there to is a very famous essay by Philip Roth, who I understand was your guest not so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote famously in 1963 that American social reality was so larger than life that it represented a real challenge to a novelist. You know, how could you compete with the extravagances of this or that mm-hmm. court case? Mm-hmm. It's a very beautiful piece, and I think mm-hmm. it became something of a locus. Yes, I mean, there always does appear, from a distance at least, a larger-than-life quality to certain dramas. I mean, the drama of The Feeding Tube, for example, well, why invent that? I mean, it's played out with such a kind of wide range of passions and moral involvements. And
massive stage, all the cameras in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a novelist
there
could feel somewhat belittled.
Yes, know, next to that.
If you were just saying, if you said to your publisher, I've been doing this Feeding Tube novel, right. Well, forget it. Because,
because we've done it. We've bigger than you'll ever do.
We've written it in neon.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I really want to hone in on this unease. Your novelists, your antenna are very acute. You look at yourself, you look at the world, and the kind of drip torture of expectation or fear that you've got all through this book, Saturday, that around any corner could be horror, and not just old-fashioned mugging-style horror, though that plays its role here too, but horror on a grand scale. Do you see that fundamentally changing even people in London? Do you see it fundamentally changing the world? We talked at the outset about how, well, all times have their difficulties, but still, the scale of this, the kind of media drip that keeps it always in our ear and at the corner of our eye, is it changing us as modern human beings?
Well, I think not, actually. I think that we are very, very adaptable, and we should get this in scale. We have open societies, we like to think, mm-hmm. and they are of their nature vulnerable. And I think we are just going to have to learn to live with the risk. The worst thing to do would to make these societies less open.
Are the British ahead of the curve, ahead of the Americans on this, given their long experience with the IRA and terror that came before 9/11?
Well, I think the British government is in danger of overreacting and curtailing a certain kind of hard-won, long-enshrined, illegal protections of individuals for the sake of diminishing that risk. No government wants it to happen on their watch. You can understand that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we mustn't sacrifice basic liberties like due process. Otherwise, we cease to become those open societies. It's a very difficult balance to strike, and it's a constant argument that needs to be made from both sides. Quite where you pitch it, you know, obviously has to be a matter that democracies work out for themselves, but I do think we risk losing something very precious about our open societies if we go too far in the wrong direction, and especially if we lose due process. Mm-hmm.
Ian McEwan, you've given us quite a ride from the very intimate to the very public. The novel, Saturday, is terrific. Enjoyed it enormously. Enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Real pleasure talking to you.
You can hear Ian McEwan reading from his new novel, Saturday, at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.